Hi, Dan Maloney from Landcom, co-sponsor of the benchmarking report, Michael. It's a great read. Recommend it to everyone when it's released. Just wanted to pick up on one of the important factors or issues in the report. I think 42% said that access to reliable and affordable housing was most important to people. Sam, with your Mervac hat on, and Michael, how do you balance that with the seeming anxiety about overdevelopment that is in the community and increasingly within government now?
Thank you for that question. I was going to use Mervac as an example when we mentioned the Lend-Lease example, because it's hard to be a developer. In this world, this binary world, you say you're a developer and people immediately think, you know, hideous, horrible, profit-making, no care for people's sense of home. And that is not the experience I have of the good end of property development in Australia, and certainly at Mervac and Lend-Lease and other places. I think we've got a really strong job to do to actually take information back into the system that we see on a daily basis and be better at what we do. And the best example I can give, two of them actually, one is led by Sue Lloyd Hurwitz at Mervac, who has taken the sustainable development goals as a key item of faith for the construction sector, to say what would actually be the best thing we could do on the renewable side, and that was the experiment with the house with no bills. So what Mervac's pioneering is, can we develop new housing across the country that would be built at an affordable level that would never have a bill again. So it would have renewable systems built into it, water and energy, to say that we actually understand that that pressure on households is so great that if you've got that cost plus your mortgage, you can't get into the housing sector at all. So we've got a trial going on at the moment about whether Australia could pioneer the development of communities that don't have to have bills because of the way they're built, and that's from low to high income. The second idea that was really pushed hard by realisation that we just cannot keep looking back and think everyone will own their own home in this country was to create a whole new asset class around build to rent. I can't tell you how hard that conversation was with Canberra about the tax concessions and the tax treatment of that asset class. But that wasn't to make lots of money. It was to say we have got to provide a very stable set of really well-built and well-finished housing solutions for people who will never get into the housing market. And we're not just talking about first home buyers, we're talking about families who are at the behest of landlords who can turf you out from time to time, when there are families now that need to be in stable accommodation, rental accommodation, to see their kids through schooling. So the build to rent model, which is getting some currency now in this country, copying the US, is to say let's actually build rental accommodation that's affordable, that has long lease times on it, that gives families the ability to live safely and happily in a location close to schooling without the thought that a landlord's about to increase the rent or turf them out. And I think that kind of innovation came because Sue and the team and the property sector more generally at its best realised that this social licence to operate does require you to rethink what you're building, where you're building it, why you're building it, and not just to always assume that people with money are going to turn up. It was very much around how do we involve ourselves in a community and rethink the whole notion of affordable housing at all levels of the system and not just benefit those that at the top end. But it does require creative thinking. It requires taking on policymakers and those that think that that's a give up on the right to own your own home, which was a very difficult conversation we had to navigate. But I think we've got to be really creative, do things out in communities that don't have access to this kind of structure and infrastructure. We've got to be better at it and be leaders about it. It's a lot to do.
That is such a comprehensive answer. I don't really think I can add terribly much other than to say this. In your question, I know you think at Landcom, you think deeply about these issues, but in your question, were all the sort of binary shortcuts that people take when they talk about housing affordability? So how can we have more affordable housing when people are worried about overdevelopment? And so built into that is the only response to affordability is supply, which is, as you know, not entirely true. Second, that the only way to manage supply is to have greater density, and that greater density equals towers all over Sydney, so we end up looking like Shanghai. And so people can go in two steps from I'd like more affordable housing to, oh my God, I'm going to be living in Shanghai and I don't want to do that. When in fact, a mature debate would start with, well, what kind of city do we want? And if you said, well, we want an equitable city, and we want a city in which things are accessible to people. We want a city in which people commute for a shorter period of time. We want a city where the city is sustainable, its use of resources is minimised, and where people live in great places. Now, if you start there and say, well, how do we deliver that to everybody? Then you end up with a set of answers, which is not towers, actually. It's actually medium density. Would still be a city with lesser density than most of the cities that we all like to travel around the world to visit. It would be a city with lesser density, but it would be a city which offers choice to people in terms of the kind of housing that they want to live in, the ownership model or the rental model they want to use, and which gives them flexibility at different times of their life, so that when they have a young family, they can live in one kind of place. When they're older, they might live in another kind of place, but they can always live in the same community. And if you started the conversation almost with what we said before, what's value to you? What is prosperity to you? And you took away the list of things, then you do start, I think, to end up with results that people not only can tolerate, but they actually really want and will pay a premium for.
Got a question over here.
Thanks. Hi there, I'm Beck Dawson. I'm the Chief Resilience Officer for Metropolitan Sydney with 100 resilient cities and the councils across Sydney. We did some research, and congratulations, I think it's a great piece. It reflects very clearly some of the messaging that we've been hearing in our community workshops and engagement across Sydney. But I wanted to pick up on narrative, because I think narrative is a really interesting issue that you're all raising in terms of how do we tell the story, how do we get people, I guess, in the decision-making positions where they sit, understanding how they can communicate, but also what story are they selling us. And I always ask the question, who is the economy for? And it's a really simple question, but it's one that isn't actually answered very often or very well. In a city where we have people that they're really the social assets, though in a knowledge economy, those human assets actually generate the economy. They, in a city environment in particular, you need those people turning up for work, you need them in a range of different education layers, and to be able to do a whole range of issues. So the infrastructure and support services in cities in particular support the knowledge economy by supporting people. And I think that people lens has kind of been missing. So what we see in the discussions we've had looking at resilience is that climate and health and financial losses are being transferred down through the layers to the layer at the bottom, or the layers, and there's multiple layers actually, that are being affected, I guess, in asymmetry. That's really causing those issues, that means that we're not doing it. So my question is, it's also a pragmatic issue, because if that narrative then isn't translated through the economic modelling at Treasury, in banks, in the structures of how decisions are made, how are the human assets and people prioritised in the decision-making of where the dollars go, in how we understand that support, that structure, that we create that human capital to make our knowledge economy work? How will that work?
I think you should answer that.
I mean, for starters, I think one of the things that we're all talking about is, and it's sort of the point I was trying to make, is that if you focus on one indicator of prosperity, chances are it's not going to capture everything. And we've used a shorthand of look at this great record run of economic growth. And I'm not trying to say we shouldn't be proud of the fact that we've managed to keep our economy ticking over at a time when other countries have had terrible circumstances. And we've avoided things like a generation of young unemployed people who will be forever impacted by the fact that they weren't able to get meaningful employment for the first, 8 years of their working lives. My point is that you miss, if you focus just on one thing, you miss all of this complexity. In the same way that, one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking is that social capital, the connectivity, the community connectivity, all of these things matters, but we often, it's difficult to measure, and it often sort of is seen as something that will happen if you get economic growth right. And I guess what we're trying to say is that it hasn't happened, and it certainly hasn't happened for everyone, and that's what we did some work earlier on the year in inequality, and it showed that as well. How do you get to a better place? My little soapbox at the moment is on transparency about what you're trying to achieve, and getting feedback on that, and actually transparency on how well you're achieving it. And so if I look at, again, I try to think, let's look at government. The government's spending a lot of money on so many wicked problems, and it's not moving the dial at all. right, at all. Now, part of the problem is actually there's no accountability for that. So much of the money that's spent, you know, is not spent with a KPI next to it that says we expect this outcome from this money. It's just spent on a program, and the assumption is the program's going to deliver that outcome with it without anyone coming back to that. In the same way that I think a lot of businesses have started talking about certain things, they talk about social license. I think a lot of companies are doing great things. They've been talking about shared value and things like that. That's all great, but to me, the question is, how do you measure it, and where is the transparency around that? And how do we get a sense that the things that matter to us are things that you are actually delivering? And again, I don't want to beat up on the banks, but one of the things that's come out of the Banking Inquiry, Royal Commission, is that there were complaints that weren't managed that went on and on and on and on. And if you drew a thread through some of those complaints, you could actually draw a line straight back to the failings that are now attracting so much attention. So if someone in business says to me, well, what do we do about that? I say, you tell the community that your understanding of what matters to them are these things, and this is how you are delivering against them. And so that's sort of my sort of long-winded way of how I think you get to that, that ultimately you have to demonstrate that you've listened to people, you have to give them your version of what you've heard, and then you actually have to show with some degree of credibility that you are trying to deliver that and how well you're delivering.
I agree entirely with that, and I think one of the things that is a great opportunity for us in the future is that government now, through technology, has such an opportunity to find out from people before they come up with ideas, what is it that you value, and what's most important to you in the next little while, and what must you keep, and what are you prepared to give away? And to just give you an example, I was asked recently to go and speak to a group of people in Ku-ring-gai about housing density. Right? So I walk into this very hostile room, and people said, we don't want density, we hate density, everything about density is horrible. And I asked, you know, five questions. Would you like to live in Ku-ring-gai when you retire? Yes. Would you like your children to live close to you? Yes. Do you think it's a good idea if the teacher at your local school lives near the school? Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And we just went through a bunch of questions like that. And what do you know? People actually really value a whole lot of things which bind community together. And at the end of the day, if they can be satisfied that holding on to that requires some small changes to things that they really don't care about as much, then people are prepared to make the changes. And I think what happens is government doesn't ask that question enough and doesn't frame things broadly enough for that to happen.
I think it's a great answer. I'm not an economist either, and I want to congratulate the city on the work you're doing, because I think you've changed the narrative from disaster to resilience, and that has currency. But as soon as you said Treasury, and so I go to ERC, I go to sort of the processes that determine things, in a world where we have all these things set as if that's the only way we judge value and we judge what does prosperity or the economy really look like. And to your point, I think we've got to have different conversations about the externalities. Now, it's a terrible phrase or term, the externalities, but we've been forgetting about them and not bringing them in, and Treasury and other people who are burdened by that decision about the cost-benefit often aren't dealing with the externalities. They're certainly not dealing with the human impacts. And I saw Mark Scott yesterday, who went from running the ABC to running the New South Wales Education Department, and it was so enjoyable to talk to someone who's now a senior bureaucrat in education, who brought all sorts of different skills and capacities to that job and didn't have to come up through education to do it. And it just reminded me that these big decisions and these understanding of what those externalities are require lots of conversations. They require lots of people with different skills from different parts of our economy moving and not staying always in business or in government or in local government or the Treasury, but actually moving around and sharing that knowledge and getting a better understanding of what it is we're actually trying to deal with when we think about the future and the cost of that future.
So I think we've got time for... I've got one question here. Which was first? Yeah, so question here, and if you're quick, then we'll go to that question.
Okay, Dean Lynch, Snowy Hydro. Two questions. First one, just great work you've done. But the demographics of actually where some of the data's come from, I see a low number of probably from the regions. So my question probably first, do you think you've got a fair representation of region with the answers you've got on that? Because I know it's been a lot very metro-based. Yes, you're going to say yeah?
Yeah, no, it's done. It's a robust survey that demographically matches to give you a population balance in terms of the answers. So that's that.
Okay, because yeah, obviously a company that does operate in the regions and plus very regionally based myself. But yeah, the second question there, some of that I agree with what you said, a lack of services, particularly in the regions, and of course aged care. I think there's a figure there in that survey which says probably to meet the requirements, we're going to need probably $50 billion worth of investment to actually meet the upcoming the tsunami of probably aged care services. But then, to provide that, then my next question is, you actually talk about inclusiveness, our speakers did, in our society, but actually then there's a feeling of actually lack of people not wanting foreign ownership. So my question is, okay, $50 billion, and potentially some of that's going to be in the regions, where's the money going to come from if people don't want foreign ownership?
So I'll weigh in quickly on this. Yeah, no, that stat's not from our survey, but it is. I've seen the work that underpins that. PricewaterhouseCoopers did some stuff on social infrastructure needs, and I actually sit on a board that deals with aged care and a bunch of other related services. This is a real challenge for our society, and it's one that actually sits at the core of some of the issues we were trying to raise in this survey, which is community expectations matter. Community expectations aren't going down in terms of the sorts of things that matter to them, nor should they. And if anything, the pressure for delivering many of these services is going to change, increase enormously. So how do we do that? The way you sort of square the circle on all of this is actually new ways of thinking about how we deliver those services. And the challenge that's revealed in this survey is that the community doesn't have a lot of faith in that at the moment, is my read on it, which is why they're looking for the public sector to deliver it. My own personal view is that the public sector is not going to be able to afford to build the infrastructure, the aged care infrastructure, in the way that we provide aged care now, and to do it in a way which matches with all of the demographics all the way around the country, number one. Number two, there are actually new ways of providing those services that enhance the quality of life for people as well, and ageing at home and those sorts of issues are really fundamentally important. How we think about delivering services so that becomes a safe and high quality experience for people living in their homes is also a huge challenge, but one which technology can play a part in, but also service delivery in different ways can play a part in. But if we think that we can do that without getting collaboration across the government sector, across the business sector, and involving community groups and the community themselves so that they have a belief that those outcomes are going to be what they want, then I think we're being naive. So I think that's the challenge. If you go overseas and have a look at innovation in human service delivery anywhere else in the world, it's place-based. The number of times I've had conversations with people where they've said it's not about economies of scale, and it's about service delivery in the home, whether it's healthcare, aged care, whatever, and that's where we're going to have to be thinking. But we have to do that in a way which is innovative, which fundamentally requires productivity improvements. But we need to bring the community with us in a way that enlists their support in the aspiration. Should we go to this last question then? I've just cut you guys off, so.
Okay, just the last question then. So I'm from Danielle Doherty from New South Wales Treasury. I was very inspired by your dialogue, Sam and Michael. Thank you. As a public servant in their kind of mid-career, what do you have any advice to provide for inspired public servants who want to make a difference, face the usual constraints in a day-to-day job? Do you have any pointers for us to enhance the effectiveness of our communication skills and how we can, you know, make a difference from our level?
Thank you, and I hope you didn't take my comments on Treasury the wrong way in the earlier question. I,
as nice as possible.
No, it was. I think thank you for the work you do. I mean, I think we've got to stop thinking about public versus private and you being a public servant versus and it being any different to people working in other parts of the economy. So I think the best advice I can give you is to remain alert and curious to people who share your interests in the part of the Treasury that you're working in, and to push yourself to actually find those outliers and the people whose voices you don't get to hear if you just rely on your own channels within Treasury or within the government. I think this idea that we've all been discussing around collaboration, there's a human part of this, and part of the narrative should be that we've got to reach out and understand others and take that perspective and make us better in what we do. It might mean that your career takes you into the private sector or into a philanthropist world or into the not-for-profit world and local government, where it could be anywhere, but I wouldn't close your mind to where you can deploy your skills and your insights. And then if you then come back into government at a higher level at some point and run one of these departments and can bring that intelligence and that sense of community, fantastic. I think we've got too many people in all parts of our economy staying sort of within their own world, and our bubbles are terrible. I think the Australian sort of notion of bubbles and what we know about each other is really quite poor, and collaboration is great for your career. And it's, I think, just remaining innately curious and open to the other. I just don't think we talk about that enough. And I deeply respect the public service. I think the findings CPD had about our democracy working if we invest more in the notion of public service and public services, that we don't just always go back to what's the private sector going to do to solve this problem, that will help us solve these issues on our way to a better future.
Great question. When I look around the world at all the cities that we like to benchmark against and admire greatly, in many of them, the greatest competition is to get into the public service. It is seen as just an extraordinary place to be and to work and to contribute to the place where people live. And I would love that to be the ambition of every public servant in New South Wales and of every graduate in New South Wales. And I think we are at a great time in New South Wales at the moment, where the top layer of the public service, I reckon, is really quite extraordinary. Tim Reardon and the people who work in and around the top layer of the public service, I think, are ambitious for the state. They want to be innovators. They want greater accountability. And they're doing, I think, really good things. I think something that they recognise and something that we talk to government about a lot is the need for real and genuine collaboration across the silos of government and between the layers of government. And in particular for New South Wales, in the next phase of what happens here, and particularly in Sydney, the capacity of the New South Wales government to collaborate with local government is going to be one of the real determinants of success or failure. And so if you get a chance to go to any kind of training around that'll hone your collaboration skills, take it and look for every opportunity to work horizontally across the state government and vertically down into and with local government. That would be my advice.